climate change and the St. John's River. JU, taking the lead on the environment. That conversation is just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, why the JU campus is putting the focus on climate change and the health of our river at two special events this weekend. We'll have a preview. You can get on the line right now with your questions at 549-2937. Then later in the hour, new technology making surgery easier for breast cancer patients in Jacksonville. Plus, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars' woes and the hot seat getting hotter for Coach Gus Bradley. All of that ahead. But first, this hour, it's a discussion of one of the most important political issues of the 20th century, the global response to climate change. Jacksonville University is hosting a forum on climate this weekend in conjunction with the 70th anniversary of the United Nations. Now, also this Saturday, JU's Marine Science Research Institute brings its event, Science on the St. John's, to the campus waterfront. It's a chance for the community to learn about the impact of the St. John's River and marine life on our area. We've got a preview of both of these right now as we welcome Dr. Stephen Baker, professor of political science at JU. Dr. Baker, good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Quint White, director of JU's Marine Science Research Institute.
Morning, Melissa.
And engineer David Bruderly, organizer and moderator of the climate event in conjunction with the UN Association of Jacksonville.
Morning.
And whether it's climate change, the health of the river, what are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We're already getting your tweets. We'll go to those in a moment. Dr. Baker, let's begin with you. This event coming up Saturday is in conjunction with the 70th anniversary of the United Nations. Why is that an important milestone to mark in conjunction with this?
Well, the fact that it is a 70th anniversary is the reason we selected the particular date. And if we are to resolve climate change, it would seem that this has to be an international effort. That's why the title of our program is Thinking Globally, Acting Locally. And what we intend to do is to present material that shows in a very objective way what the nature of climate change are and what the challenges would be, and then ask local leaders to respond to that.
David Bruderly, let's talk about some of the items on the agenda, and in particular, how you will challenge local and state leadership on the issue of climate. Florida, it's been remarked upon many times, is perhaps the most vulnerable state in the country when it comes to the potential impact of sea level rise. We're surrounded by oceans on all sides. South Florida is already seeing sea level rise impact Miami-Dade County quite regularly. Yet at the local and state levels, we're really not seeing a robust response, although in South Florida, municipalities have started working on mitigation. So how will this forum look at these issues and talk about bringing local leadership to the table?
Well, the way we've designed the forum is that we're going to have, after a proclamation from the mayor commemorating the anniversary of the UN, we're going to have a science-based presentation on just the facts. Here's the data. Here's what's actually happening in the world today, and then have a conversation of the drivers behind that. What is the cause of greenhouse gas pollution? What is the greenhouse gas effect, and how does that affect things like rising sea levels? And it's a pretty straightforward conversation. So then once we have Dr. Jeff Martin with the Department of Geography at JU make that presentation, then we're going to convene a panel and talk for as long as we can, probably about an hour and a half, something like that. The panel will consist of three folks, Dr. Alan Mosley from the Jacks Chamber, who just successfully hosted an energy conference at the Hyatt just last week with this clearly stated objective that Jacksonville wants to be an energy leader in the state of Florida, if not the Southeast. Very successful conference in that respect. Second person on the issue of sea level rise is Margo Mooring with the Regional Planning Council, and she's part of a committee that's been formed to try to address the issue of how do we adapt to rising sea levels, because there's no disagreement that sea levels are rising. The question is, what's the cause and how fast and what do we do about it? And then the third person on the panel will be Nancy Kilgo Vasey from the Jacksonville Electric Authority. She's the general counsel, and they have a very significant challenge in that we have a solid fuel generating plant that has to legally comply with the President's Clean Power Plan under the Clean Air Act of 1970. Carbon dioxide is determined by the Supreme Court to be a pollutant that can be regulated. And since the Congress has not taken any action to do things that would put a price on carbon or otherwise regulate carbon pollution from the country, that we have the President taking executive action, which is highly controversial from a political standpoint, to try to help electric utilities start to plan to reduce their carbon footprint. And so we're going to have, I think, a very interesting conversation about how do you respond to this in the most cost-effective way for the local community, and hopefully in ways that not only solve the problem but can create economic development locally and jobs by restructuring how we make our capital investments in energy and energy conservation. And we can talk about that some more.
And if you're just tuning in, we want your questions and calls about climate change and the health of the St. Johns River. Two important symposiums happening this Saturday on the JU campus, 549-2937. Dr. Quint White, director of JU's Marine Science Research Institute. The climate event happening Saturday on the JU campus. At the same time, Science on the St. Johns is coming to the JU waterfront, a day for people to learn about the impact of the river and marine life and marine science. So all across the JU campus this weekend will be a focus on our environment and our natural world.
Always a happening place. It's great. The Science on the St. John River actually is a sort of new event, but sort of an old event. For years, we've done a thing called Ripples on the River, which we did in May. But one of the problems with that was the time of the year and the students and the faculty and what have you. So we decided to move it to October and change the focus to science on the St. John's River. And so the idea is to show people what we're doing and allow them to go out and see the river. We will have boat rides on our 48 by 12 foot floating classroom, the RV Larkin. We will have a fishing clinic by Captain Don Dingman. And after the fishing clinic, the first 220 youth that get there, children that get there, get a free rod and reel. Seabass Seafood has provided lunch, and then we've also got displays around the building showing what's going on. We've got other things and activities that are focused on the St. John River also participating. So MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, will be there. Aqua Jacks, the new proposed aquarium, will be there with mermaids.
With mermaids. Wait a minute.
Mermaids.
Wait a minute. Tell me about these mermaids.
There is a group of people here in Jacksonville that enjoy being mermaids.
Are we talking like the famous Weekiwachi underwater mermaids on the other side of Florida?
Yes.
Or what kind of mermaids?
Yes, exactly. They dress up as mermaids, have very nice outfits. And I saw them at the zoo, and when I invited Aquajacks to come participate, they said, well, the mermaids want to come too. So that's fantastic.
So we're going to have mermaids walking around the JU campus.
Well, they can't walk because of their
fins. Are they going to be swimming in a tank? Are they going to be doing?
We're not getting the tank this time. Turns out the tank had to go to South Florida. Yeah, I know.
How are they going to get around?
They'll be sitting, I think, at this stage of the game.
So it's going to be like the Tom Hanks, Daryl Hannah movie Splash. They're just going to be sitting there.
They'll just be sitting
hanging
there.
Out.
Yeah,
okay.
Hanging out for the kids to have pictures with.
Very nice. But this is an excellent way for people to learn about your work and the importance of the river, this vital current coursing through our community, and why you're trying to raise awareness about the health of the St. John's.
Exactly. And it's a way for us to raise some friends and let people understand what we're doing. We've got some pretty cutting-edge research going on. And so people can get – we just got two brand-new pieces of instrumentation costing almost $400,000 that people can come and look at and see what we're doing. One has to do with harmful algae blooms. The other has to do with something called stable isotope analysis, in which we look at water, where water comes from, what's going on with the water. So it's a lot about water. So it's an exciting time. Mm-hmm. We're looking for a good crowd. We think we'll have a good time.
And Dr. Baker, these two events are not unrelated. I think it needs to be said.
Oh, no. No, we're actually committed in the long term to getting the community involved in such things. And working with the United Nations Association, the JU Political Science Society, the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, what we're doing is sponsoring a number of forums in which people are exposed to high levels of solid information, and then we invite them to participate in the discussion. A lot of people assume that democracy emerges naturally, but it doesn't. It really has to be fostered. And so what we want to do is to promote an ongoing dialogue about the major issues of the day. And climate change is certainly one of the dominant factors.
And let's go to your calls right now about two major events coming up this Saturday on the JU campus, the Global Response to Climate Change and Science on the St. John's. What are your questions? 549-2937. CJ in Jacksonville. Hi, CJ. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the guest that you have on this morning, specifically, for those of us who maybe can't make it to the event, what are the major sources of pollution that are in the St. John's River right now? Are they corporate? Are they coming from individuals? And also, what can individuals who live in Jacksonville or who live in Jacksonville Beach, what can we do sort of on our individual basis for action to try to keep the river clean? Because, you know, I live right next to the river, but I don't really necessarily do anything specific to care for it. But I wonder what could people who live in that neighborhood do?
Sure. Thanks, CJ.
That's an excellent question. And I think what people need to understand is that most of the pollution that goes into the St. John's River comes from us, individuals. And by fertilizing our yard, by watering our yard, even when we use the toilet and things like that, we're actually adding to the pollution, the nutrients going into the St. John's River. So watching what you do as an individual, and you may not think, well, gee, what I do as an individual won't make much difference. But as collectively part of over a million people living in this area now, it does make a huge difference. So, you know, using fertilizer responsibly, using pest control responsibly, looking how much water and even how much energy you use in your house. Conservation is a great economic incentive because you can save some money while you're doing it. But regretfully, it's not really corporate and, you know, industrial pollution. Rather, it's individuals. And even what JEA puts in the river comes from us.
Let me ask you, with regard to the climate event, David Bruderle, a new study out just the other day from the think tank Climate Central, issuing some dire predictions, basically saying, say goodbye to the cities of Miami and New Orleans, that no matter what we do to curb the effects of rising temperatures, those and other beloved U.S. cities are going to eventually sink between rising seas. But that if we do make extreme carbon cuts and move to renewable energy more quickly than we already are, scientists estimate that there are some cities, including Jacksonville, Florida, Sacramento, California, and a few other coastal cities, that can avoid what they call a lock-in date, a date past which there is a point of no return, a point past which there's really nothing to be done. Now, not everyone, of course, agrees with this study. There are still plenty of Americans that don't agree with these findings. But let me ask you about that. What are your thoughts about that Climate Central study? And in particular, this study singles out Jacksonville, Florida, the Chesapeake Bay, Norfolk, and Virginia Beach.
Well, let me address two things. One, with respect to the sources of pollution, there's absolutely no question that the sources of greenhouse gas pollution are human-related. I'm 68 years old, and in my lifetime, the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gas equivalent emissions in the atmosphere have increased 40%. And there's no controversy whatsoever that the primary source of those carbon dioxide and methane equivalent molecules in the upper atmosphere are due to the combustion of fossil fuels. There is no dispute about that. The question is, and the political question is that we need to be debating and discussing in a very robust way, is what do we do about this? What is the appropriate risk management response? Because you've got folks out there who are taking the worst-case scenario, and you've also got folks out there who are taking the let the good times roll. We don't need to do anything. This is going to reduce the ice in the Arctic. We can go exploit those resources. The Northwest Passage will open up, and we'll be able to go from China to Europe through the Arctic Ocean rather than through Panama Canal. So And that is one scenario that could have a very positive economic impact on the planet. But the downside of that is if you lose the ice cover in the Arctic and the grounded ice that's now sitting on hard rock in Greenland and even in Antarctica, sea levels will rise 10 meters. So this tipping point that you mentioned, or the lock-in point, there's a debate as to where is that tipping point going to be. Well, all we know today that we can say with fairly certainty is that there is a strong correlation between these atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases that I mentioned. When I was born, it was around 320 parts per million volumetric. Now it's over 400. That's a 40% increase in round numbers. And we know that there is a very strong correlation between the amount of fossil fuel that's been burned on the planet in the last 300 years and that increase. It's called the hockey stick. And when the hockey stick first came out, it shows an exponential rate of increase. And it was mocked because it was so outrageous. It was totally inconsistent with logic in the minds of many people. But the fact is that these numbers have been verified and validated. They're not controversial. And when you plug them into models, computer models that try to account for the complexity of the ocean circulations and the atmosphere and everything else, it's like trying to come up with a hurricane track. You get a lot of different answers. So there's no absolute prediction of what's going to happen that's out there. But there is how do you deal with that? That's a risk management issue. And the way business responds to risk management is you basically put your best brains together and you come up with a business plan that makes sense for the circumstances that you can understand and you can control. And that's the purpose of our panel, is to try to help Jacksonville Electric Authority, help the chamber, help the planning commission get the best minds together and start talking about this problem, not in a hysterical way, but in a fact-based, a science-based way that will bring out the best of our large brain capacity to start thinking about alternatives to the current business plans that we follow and see what we can do.
And going along with that, here's a tweet from a listener. Are coastal communities in Northeast Florida making contingency plans for sea level rise like other coastal areas around the state? Well, Dr. Baker.
Well, that's what we hope to address, is to really see that answer. And from what we know so far, the plans have been insufficient, and we really have to be on top of this.
And let me ask you both, too, as a follow-up, the upcoming talks in Paris, a landmark conference on climate being described as what is supposed to be the most ambitious agreement ever to fight the impacts of climate change. How hopeful are all three of you that this can have some sort of lasting impact?
Well, I'm quite hopeful because there's been a fundamental change in the political approach to this problem. When the much maligned Kyoto Accords were developed, that was a top-down mandate, and it failed miserably here in the United States. The conference of the parties that's taking place in Paris is called COP21. They've taken a different approach. Now it's a bottom-up. It's a grassroots type of effort, and each participating nation has been asked to show up at the conference with their estimate of what they can do to reduce their carbon footprint. And the good news on this is that Brazil has made a commitment, India has made a commitment, China has made a commitment, the United States, European Union countries, all have made commitments to start the process of reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, and they've actually set targets that range from 25% to 35% reduction from the baseline over the next 10 to 20 years. And this is unprecedented in human history to have this kind of international cooperation.
And the number to join us is 549-2937. Dr. White, if we're looking at a scenario by the year 2035, according to this Climate Central study, 25% of Jacksonville underwater, that significantly changes the makeup of the St. Johns River.
Oh, it does. And we're seeing that already because with the water withdrawal is already coming from the aquifer, and the amount of paving and impervious surface that we've created, we've changed the salinity, we've changed the ecology of the river, and this is going to continue to happen. If we deepen the river, that's going to exacerbate the situation, and you add climate change on top of that. I worry that I am optimistic that we'll do something, but I'm a little concerned that We have a tendency to wait until we have a crisis. We understand we have problems, we don't deal with them. And then we wait until we have a crisis, and then we do something. And we've done this in the past. We did it with ozone and the CFLs. We did it with our CFCs. We did it with acid rain. And I think we can do things, but it's going to take a committed political leadership that right now doesn't seem to be appearing.
What about that, Dr. Baker? Let's talk about that, because we hear these studies coming out, a new one almost every month. They're increasingly dire. The newest one is saying we're looking at a 20-year timetable now. 20 years. That is much closer than some of the earlier studies that talked about the year 2100 or 2080. People
right.
hear 2035 and they think, well, that's within my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of Americans look at that and think, well, that I just don't buy that. I just don't see that. So what about that?
Well, hopefully we are changing. Now, the nature of democracy is to wait until things really get out of control and then to take extreme measures to deal with them. And we've seen this in the past. And that's why I want this issue that, as Mr. Brutley was saying, the top-down issue that the United Nations has taken, they're rejecting that. They're saying that we ought to have each country make its own commitments because they're much more willing to abide by that. Many of the countries in the initial versions of this really weren't willing to do that. And the United Nations is doing that, moving away from the Millennium Development Goals now to the Sustainable Development
Speaking
Goals, which are quite different.
The UN, Nicole tweets the show, please comment on the fact that climate change around the world affects women and girls in multiple ways more than men. David Bruderle, can you speak to that?
Well, poor folks in general are going to be badly impacted in nations like Bangladesh, where they are literally inches above sea level and are already suffering the problems of extreme storm events. That's a given. I want to talk about the economic development opportunity here, because there is a precedent for what's happening at the UN, and that is a precedent that has been set by a rather arcane organization called the International Maritime Organization that is sponsored by the UN. This came out of the safety of life at sea and the prevention of pollution at sea of ships. There is a treaty signed that the United States has been a participant in for many, many years. And in 2011, that treaty was extended beyond oil spills and sewage to address the issue of motor fuels that fuel the ships. And we now have an example here in Jacksonville of how we're having ships being built to run on a low-carbon motor fuel called liquefied natural gas to reduce their carbon footprint. And that's a direct result of this international treaty that the United States is a signatory to. And it works because it's a voluntary commitment by the shipping companies to do it because they want to stay in business.
Well, with all of that said, two major events happening this Saturday on the JU campus, and they are open to the public, so get out and enjoy them. Science on the St. John's from 10 to 2 Saturday at the Marine Science Research Institute. This is going to be a lot of fun, and this is a way for kids and adults to discover what marine research on the St. John's is all about. The first 220 kids get a free rod and reel from Fish Florida, river tours, live music, food, fun. This is a great event, Dr. Quint White. So people need to really get out and enjoy the river. This is $10 for adults, kids under 18, free. So it's Science on the St. John's Saturday, and then the Global Response to Climate Change also Saturday at JU, 3 to 5 p.m. at JU's Gooding Auditorium. Thank you all so much, Dr. Quint White, Dr. Stephen Baker, David Bruderle. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll have a videographer there, too.
Excellent. And much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the Jags' latest loss and why Coach Gus Bradley's seat is getting hotter. But right now, we want you to join loyal listeners like Rachel Curry of Jacksonville. She got in touch with me and asked me to say her name on the air. So, hi, Rachel. Support 89.9 with your pledge. Here's how.
The number to call right now is 353-9528, or go to WJCT.org and click on that support button. Good morning. I'm Jessica Palumbo, the news director here at WJCT, and I'm joined by
Michelle Corum. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And Jessica, you know, I was driving through Orlando, and off to the right, my husband said, well, there's the St. John's River.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, it's up in this direction as well. well. So, and I remember thinking as we were going across it, I know so much more about the St. John's River because of what I learn on First Coast Connect and the knowledgeable guests that come and tell us how what we do affects the health of the St. John's River.
That's
and,
right.
You know, the future of it and the past of it and all that you can learn on this program that is a jewel here to WJCT.
Absolutely.
It's First Coast Connect. And if you want to help right now, you can call 904-353-9528.
As those JU scientists were saying, they want people to think globally and act locally. They're trying to foster democracy by creating a robust discussion on the issues of the day. And that really struck me as very familiar to the mission of WJCT and First Coast Connect. And I really liked how they said it was not a hysterical discussion, but fact-based and rational.
Fact-based.
And that's what you get when you listen to WJCT, whether it's First Coast Connect or reporting from the WJCT news team that's used all throughout the day during Morning Edition, during the program that you host, Michelle, and All Things Considered in the afternoons. Not hysterical, but fact-based and rational. If that's what you love, then call us now, 353-9528 or WJCT.org. Click the support button. We have volunteers all day ready to take your calls. Thank you to everybody who's donated so far. We've raised almost $10,000 already, and we'd like to thank a couple of you. Anwar in Jacksonville, April in Woodbine, Georgia, Pam from McClenny, Andrea in St. Augustine, John from St. John's, Sarah from Salem, Virginia. WJCT is your community and your world, and anywhere in the world you can listen to it on the WJCT app anytime, anywhere. We'd also like to thank Vicky in Jacksonville. Thank you for your pledges. And if you haven't called yet, now's the time, 353-9528, WJCT.org. Click support and thanks. Well, a new device is making surgery safer and less traumatic for patients on the First Coast with breast cancer. St. Vincent's Hospital is one of only four hospitals around the country using this new technology. It's called the FlowBeam, an infrared camera that's used during breast reconstructive and implant surgeries. Dr. Michael Faluco is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon at St. Vincent's Riverside, and he joins us now with more as we mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And this is exciting. So for women undergoing surgery, this is a device that can really help the patient be put at ease, almost like an extra set of eyes in the OR.
Exactly. What this device does is it lets us see the blood flow. So everything in plastic surgery, we're designing our surgery and our plan around the blood flow. And if we can actually see how that works, the outcome is safer and patients do better, they recover faster.
How does the FlowBeam work?
So how it works is in the surgery, when the patient is asleep, we have a handheld device and it's a near-infrared camera. The anesthesiologist will give a dye through that'll go through the bloodstream, and with this camera, it'll actually light up and the blood flow will start to light up almost like a tree. And so when, for instance, if I'm taking tissue from the belly to reconstruct the breast, which is called a deep flap, what I can do is I can see where that strong areas of blood flow are, take that tissue only to transfer for the new breast, so we're transferring 100% viable, healthy tissue.
Wow, that's amazing. That's such a huge advance, isn't it? So less trauma for the patient, less surgeries overall?
It is. And, you know, it's like X marks the spot. If I can see where the blood flow goes, I have to cause less trauma surgically and overall speeds up the operation.
How did St. Vincent's become one of only four medical centers to obtain this technology?
Well, it's a large push of St. Vincent's breast health. We have a very dedicated team approach, and this was one of the aspects of the team that we wanted to improve. So safety is everything, and St. Vincent's really pushed for that.
And you're going to continue that push this Wednesday at the Maggiano's at the St. John's Town Center with an event that has an irresistible name, Bra Day.
Yes, yes.
All right, Doctor, what is happening at Bra Day?
So Bra Day is a national event. This is our fifth year running it, and it's Breast Reconstruction Awareness Day. And at 6 o'clock at Maggiano's, what we'll do is we'll have women who've had all different types of reconstruction, implant, the deep flap, latissimus, and they'll be there in a one-on-one environment where a patient who's contemplating reconstruction can go back and actually see what a reconstructed breast looks like versus searching on the internet and just have a community of support of women who've gone through the process.
Because it can be a scary experience. So seeing someone who's been through it, I think, would be really reassuring.
It is. You know, our goal as plastic surgeons is to make someone's life better. And they get this diagnosis, and all of a sudden everything's put in their face. Wow, life's going to change. So if we can put them at ease with an event like this and really show them that life is going to be good going forward, that's what the night's all about. And it's fun. We have food, drinks, but they've got a RSVP because it's a limited number of seats.
All right. So let's get that information out. So they need to go to?
Yeah. So they'll call 904-262-3372, and they can reserve a spot for them and their significant other for Brade.
That's 262-3372. Brade, Wednesday night at Maggiano's for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. He's Dr. Michael Faluco with St. Vincent's Riverside. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And we're back in a moment.
So, where do you listen to WJCT?
Hi, I'm Ruth Ann Hepler. I listen to 89.9 always in the car. I listen to it in the bedroom and bathroom when I'm getting ready in the morning and when I come home at night, in the kitchen when I'm making breakfast, and any other time I can.
WJCT is here for you anytime, anywhere. Call now with your pledge of support, 904-353-9528.
On the next Fresh Air, raising a transgender child. Kelly and Wayne Maines knew when they became parents of identical twin baby boys there would be some challenges, but they weren't prepared when one of their children started identifying as a girl. We'll speak with them and with Amy Ellis Nutt, author of a book about the family. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, described as an innovative and prolific scholar by Foreign Policy and named as one of the magazine's top 100 global thinkers 4 years in a row, Anne Marie Slaughter is a noted foreign policy expert and former top official at the State Department. But it was an article she wrote for The Atlantic magazine about work-life balance and how tough it is for professional women that struck a chord with so many people. Anne Marie Slaughter is speaking tomorrow night in Jacksonville, courtesy of the World Affairs Council. That talk is sold out, but I had the opportunity to speak with her about foreign affairs, work, family, and more. Take a listen. Anne Marie Slaughter, welcome to the program. A pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
The talk you're going to be giving in Jacksonville is titled Global Hotspots and Blind Spots. Now, I think most of us have a pretty good idea of where the hotspots are. But I'm intrigued by the title, the phrase blind spots in the title of your talk. Where are the blind spots?
Well, that's really the heart of the talk, which is that we look at all the hot spots in the world, Ukraine or Iran or Syria or the South China Sea, in terms of what I call the chessboard of great power relations, right? We see the EU and the U.S. versus Russia, or we see, again, Iran and Russia versus the West, or China versus Japan and the United States and other Southeast Asian states. And that's right, but what we're missing are the ways to see these incidents in terms of businesses and people and digital activists, so that just to give you one example, if you look at Ukraine, this is really as much about how the Ukrainian people want a decent government free of corruption as it is a conflict between Russia and the West, and it's about Putin's fear that that same desire and the success of those people will spread to Moscow.
What do you think of recent charges that the Obama administration is failing to lead when it comes to Syria, and that Syria has that the conflict there, that Syria has become a proxy, and that Putin's actions there are amounting to a sort of a proxy war between the West and the East, and that Syria is so destabilized that our strategy there is an utter failure. When you see those criticisms, what are your thoughts?
Well, I have been a very sharp critic of the Obama administration's policy toward Syria for 3.5 years, since February of 2012. And I should say, I think there are other areas in which President Obama is going to leave an enormous foreign policy legacy. But here, everything that is happening now actually was predictable years ago, because this is this is a fight between millions of Syrians and their government, a government that, you know, started by shooting on peaceful protesters and torturing children and has escalated to killing hundreds of thousands of people with barrel bombs, and is still using chemical weapons. And the United States simply has not acted to protect the Syrian people, either by safe zones, and of course we wouldn't do this alone. This would be with Turkey and other Middle Eastern countries as well as other European countries, but safe zones, and I've advocated, as has General Petraeus, that we actually take out Assad's Air Force to prevent him from dropping these horrible barrel bombs on his population. But until we wrestle with that and then get a political settlement in Syria, we can't address ISIL or any of the other horrific conflicts that are now spreading across the region.
And should we adequately address Syria? How do you see the issue of ISIL, and what can the West do when it comes to the proliferation of jihadists joining ISIL in Iraq and Syria?
Well, you know, I'm known as pushing for intervention in Syria, but actually on ISIL, I have a different view, which is if we need to act with other countries in the region and our allies to contain it, to prevent them from expanding territory, but that in the end, although we have to protect ourselves through intelligence and special operations and the ways we've been fighting terrorist networks for a long time now, this is an intra-Muslim fight or an intra-Islamic fight. This is like the fight between the Protestants and the Catholics during the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and outside powers are not going to be able to resolve it. So again, it is very important to get a political settlement in Syria so that Turkey and Iran and the Syrians themselves and the Saudis and the Jordanians and we can concentrate on containing ISIL and ultimately addressing this tremendous internal conflict. But that's not a fight we're going to win.
Of course, you're so well known for your foreign policy credentials. You're also known, and I have to ask you about this, for a piece you wrote for The Atlantic, the most read article in the history of The Atlantic, titled Why Women Still Can't Have It All. I've read this piece so many times. As someone who works full-time and is married with two children, it resonated with me so incredibly strongly. You left the State Department after 2 years because it just became too difficult for you to maintain any kind of work-life balance. And the argument that you made in this article is that the workplace simply has not accepted the reality of modern-day family life, and that the workplace and that the school system, our school system as well, needs to change, that we need to accept that families have a different reality today. Can you talk a little bit about the repercussions of that article, and do you think that the ideas that you put forth in it have made an impact?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about the article, particularly since I've spent the last 3 years writing a book that's just come out last month called Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family, that really is not, it's not an extension of the article because my ideas have changed and grown, and I now think I really do see the way forward, which is exactly, this is not a women's problem, this is a work problem, it is a national problem. We have a 21st century workforce that is, you know, certainly half women, 60% of American women are in the workforce, 70% of mothers, and the workplace is still stuck back in the 1950s and 1960s with the assumption that, you know, it's like Leave It to Beaver, that somebody is at home when all those unpredictable things happen that inevitably happen if you're caring for children or if you're caring for parents, which is equally important as a coming challenge. So I think that the conversation, and I credit Sheryl Sandberg also for really pushing this conversation and doing tremendous work, has continued since I published my article. I think you're seeing it on Hillary Clinton's agenda. It's one of her four fights that she's really pushing for, but you're also seeing Marco Rubio put out a plan for paid leave. So it is now time to see this is not a women's issue. This is a work issue. It's a middle class issue. It's an economic issue. I frankly think it's a national security issue, because if we can't invest properly in our children, we will not be competitive going forward, and we may not be able to defend ourselves.
When you talk about that in front of corporate leaders and people in the military and in government, what kind of reaction do you get?
What's very interesting, the military is strongly supportive. The military understands completely that this is about investing in human capital. Right? The Pentagon has on-site daycare and pays its daycare providers, who are really early education providers, the same as it pays its elementary and secondary school teachers. So the Pentagon gets it. They know that unless we can invest properly in the next generation, we really are going to be in trouble from their point of view in terms of defending the country. But also military men get this often much better than civilian men, in part because we now have military women. We have soldiers who are men and women, and if mom is deployed, then dad's the lead parent. And there's just no question about that. Somebody's got to be there. And also, when military men are deployed and they're overseas for a long time, often when they come back, they say, it's my wife's turn. So I'm going to be the lead parent at home, and I'm going to support her in getting her degree or really ramping up her career. So very positive from the military and from corporate leaders. The ones who get it are the ones who say, this is about reinventing the workplace. You know, we are moving into a full digital economy, and you can't run a digital economy with a workplace that still assumes, you know, we work in factories and offices, and those are the places, or the only places, work can get done. So those business leaders with imagination and those who understand how much talent they're wasting by losing so many mothers after, you know, they find that it's just too difficult to combine traditional work with family, those leaders are reinventing how we work and are looking for ways to retain that talent and attract that talent.
And you also, your husband's also written articles about this too, talking about the fact that at home in your household, often he's the lead parent, and that and that you're both fine with that.
Absolutely. I mean, he wrote a piece called, you know, Why I Put My Wife's Career First, and he says, you know, it's been better for our marriage, and it's been better for our children, and ultimately he says it's been better for him, that he has a relationship with our sons that is really far, far closer than the relationship he had with his father. He was close to his father, but his father was often not there. And he has been, you know, a fabulous parent for our sons. You know, he has a full-time job, too, as so many of us do, right? I mean, this is not, you know, most Americans do not have a choice about, you know, not working. It's a question of how you work and take care of those who you love. And that is a question for men just as much as for women.
Well, it's wonderful to speak with you. And of course, your talk is sold out here in Jacksonville. So at least our listeners can hear you speak. Anne Marie Slaughter, a pleasure. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you. Thanks so much.
We'll be right back. Well, finally, this hour, the seat is getting hotter under Gus Bradley after the Jaguars' most recent loss. I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Cole Pepper on the line now with a recap of sports. And Cole, boy, I wouldn't want to be Bradley right now.
No, you remember when we talked at the beginning of the season was about what, you know, how hot was the seat under Gus Bradley? And I said, that, you know, the fire hadn't started, but maybe there's some folks collecting some kindling. I think they've now started to stack up the pyre and maybe have the lighter fluid out. The match maybe hasn't been lit, but after the most recent loss, the Jaguars now 1-5, dropping the decision yesterday to the Houston Texans. And maybe the good news here is that the Jaguars won't be back in Jacksonville playing for another month because they've got road games and a bye and the trip to London. But at 1-6, the Jaguars now, or rather 1-5 after six games, the Jaguars now sit in the position where if the season ended today, they would have the number one pick in the draft. So if you want some good news, perhaps that's it. But the third year of Gus Bradley's reign, and the Jaguars have won just 8 out of 38 games in the last 2 years plus. Obviously, there's something that's not working here. And you have to take the assessment about whether it's the players or the coaching or some combination thereof. And the fan base, by and large, very disappointed with the way that this team has been coached and the approach that Gus Bradley has taken, which is, you know, by and large, a very player-friendly approach, maybe isn't the right one with a team as young as the Jaguars are. It might work with a more veteran team, but with a young team like the Jaguars, it just hasn't produced the results.
So they're not back at home for a month, Cole. Not a team that always does well on the road. We'll have to, I guess, keep our fingers crossed for a few wins, though.
Yeah, and I'm not, you know, the London trip is part of that. And again, I'm not sure that this is necessarily anything about playing at home or playing on the road. It may actually provide a little bit of a break. I talked to some of the players after the game yesterday in the locker room about whether this was a good time for the London thing to London trip to come up. Blake Bortles kind of caught himself. He was about to say, I don't know if there's ever a good time for the trip to London. And I think realized, hey, maybe I shouldn't say that because the owner is behind this whole move. But this is a team really looking for answers right now. And I think the fan base, a lot of them anyway, certainly feel like they have the answer, or at least they have part of the answer, which is to get rid of the coach. We'll see if that happens before the season's end.
Sure. Let's talk college football, Florida, Georgia, and Florida State. At least it was good football weather this weekend, right?
It was. And actually, you know, I would say for the Gators, even though they sustained their first loss of the season, the way that they lost, and that they lost on the road at LSU, playing in Death Valley, one of the toughest places to play, particularly for a night game against, you know, probably the Heisman front runner and Leonard Fournette, the running back from LSU. I think the Gators have to feel good about where they are at this point. Just lost their first game again, so that's a real positive. Georgia, on the other hand, really limping along. They did manage to win 9-6 over Missouri, but this is a banged-up Georgia team, and the Florida-Georgia game coming up here in a couple of weeks is not looking like one that the Georgia fans are looking forward to nearly as much, at least not on the field. Maybe an off-the-field experience will be a good one for them. On the other hand, Florida State just keeps winning. They're still undefeated. And Dalvin Cook, the running back, starting to get a little bit of a conversation as far as a Heisman Trophy candidate. He has just absolutely been terrific running the football. He's fifth in the nation in terms of yards per game. And although I don't think he's going to wind up winning the thing, he is going to get some pretty serious consideration for the Heisman this year.
Very nice. And JU undefeated. How about it?
They keep hauling. Kerwin Bell's team's off to the best start in school history. And they've got road games coming up the next 2 weeks. I think that's going to tell the tale of their season. But hats off to Kerwin Bell, whose team, you might recall, had to surrender any chance at a championship because of some academic questions from last year. They've really come back with a vengeance this year.
Now, we need to talk about Daniel Murphy, the JU alum, who is on this major hot streak for the Mets. This is really cool.
Yeah, he has been absolutely on a tear. And Inglewood High School product, JU alum. And, in fact, I've known Daniel for a long time. I was calling the JU games on radio when he was playing at JU. And a terrific guy and a great hitter. And has just been tearing it up. He now has 5 home runs off of 4 of the best pitchers in the National League during the postseason for the Mets, including hitting one last night in the Mets' victory. They're up 2-0 in the best-of-7 series against the Cubs. I'll tell you a quick story about Daniel Murphy. When he was a freshman at JU, and they introduced the freshman, they were going around the locker room. The guy would say, "I'm Tom Smith. I'm the second baseman from Palm Beach, and I'm Jack Armstrong, and I'm a pitcher from Tallahassee." It came to Murphy, and he said, "Daniel Murphy from Jacksonville, I bat third." Didn't even mention his fielding position because it was all about his hitting, and he continued to do that in the majors.
Wow, awesome. And we're out of time, but the Armada won Saturday, an amazing win for them. And thanks for getting on the phone with us, Cole. As always, great to talk to you. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we're out of time. Right now, we need you to support us here at 89.9. Here's how.
You can call us right now at 353-9528 or go to WJCT.org and click on the support button. Hi, I'm Jessica Palumbo, news director here at WJCT. That was Cole Pepper, one of our regular contributors to First Coast Connect. He's here every Monday with sports. And like so many people here at WJCT, Cole does this out of the goodness of his heart. He's a volunteer. We depend on volunteers to answer the phones here so many times and to take your calls during pledge drive. And that's just part of what makes WJCT great. We depend on the support of the community to do what we do every day. And that doesn't just mean volunteering their time, but also financially. And now is the time. It's the fall pledge drive. The number is 353-9528. If you love First Coast Connect, if you love hearing The Spectator, Carrie Speckman, come in every Thursday and talk about the weekend news, if you love the media roundtable on Fridays, or if you just really value the robust discussions that Melissa Ross hosts every single day of the weekday on the news of the day and the biggest issues that are affecting the First Coast and the world. If you love this programming, 353-9528. Call us now. Let us know. Thank you for your support. Go to WJCT.org now and click support. And thank you for listening.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.